Charles Blow is a very popular New York Times columnist and author of the new book, The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. The book discusses his plan for black Americans to amass political power by reverse migration to the South in order to achieve black majorities in multiple states. Blow says he never wanted to write a race book, but his violence against black people, both physical and psychological, seemed only to increase in recent years, culminating in the historic pandemic and protests of the summer of 2020. He felt compelled to write a new story for black Americans. Blow envisions a succinct, counterintuitive, and impassioned corrective to the myths that have for too long governed our thinking about race and geography in America. Drawing in both political observations and personal experience as a black son of the South, Charles set out to offer a call to action by which black people can finally achieve equality on their own terms. Again, the name of the book is The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto, and it's a pleasure to welcome Charles Blow back to our program. Thank you very much for being here. A great pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
So you make this apparent, but for people who have not read the book, The Devil You Know. The devil in this case is racism, correct?
Yes, exactly.
So let us, to put that term, to put racism in that context, and to ultimately give us an idea of how you came up with this proposal, this manifesto, how did the gears start to turn on this?
You know, people have asked me that, and I can't exactly pinpoint. I mean, I remember the night I began to write the book proposal, which was about three years ago. But the best I can recall is that the migration of young white people to Vermont was in my mind. It had just become into my consciousness. And this was in 1972, two young Yale Law students write a paper in the Yale Law Review called Jamestown 70, and in which they are talking to young hippies in the Northeast, primarily, but in America, who are protesting Nixon's execution of the war and not getting big protests, but not getting anywhere. Some violence, but not getting anywhere. And because Nixon continues to execute the war the way he wants to, and they lay out this plan and say, you know, your way of revolution is not going to work. But what you can do is this thing we call radical federalism, which is you can just take over a state. You just move. And that kind of language is for a few months until a more prominent writer picks it up and writes an article for Playboy in, under the title Take Over Vermont. And he lays out the math. And in the years after, tens of thousands of young white people, liberals, move en masse to Vermont. And they don't do it because they have a job waiting, a great housing. Some people sleep in fields. They develop communes, all sorts of things. But they transform Vermont from one of the most conservative states in America to one of the most liberal. It was the place in 2018 where Barack Obama wins his highest percentage of the white vote. Mm-hmm. It is the place that produces people like Bernie Sanders. They basically changed Vermont from New Hampshire into Vermont. And to see that work, and to see it not even take a majority, to see that work so easily, and to know that the reason black people don't have state power now is because they were terrorized out of it, which is a victory they cannot be allowed to stand, it became very clear to me that one way to get it was to basically reverse the organization and do with political intentionality what these young white people had done.
So when it comes to your idea of this recolonization, tell us the proposal of what you would like to see done by African Americans in this country.
I would like to see them move back to the South. I mean, it is literally that simple. I target nine states, particularly the South, which is a huge region of the country. It has, I think, like 15, 16 states. 15, I think. But I only target nine of those, and they all have populations already of 25% or more black populations. that is Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware. And I say move into those states.
Mm-hmm. The idea of, for in some cases, a return, but for a new generation, this would be new. So what is the motivation to tell people, yes, this is something that, that we should do to improve the situation that we live in now?
All right. So the with the original migration, there was a push and a pull. The push was pushed out of the South was white terror and the economic collapse of the cotton industry with the infestation of the boll weevil. The pull was northern industry needed more workers because many of the young white workers had gone away to the World War One, and in addition to that, there was the possibility of more freedom, social, economic, and political. I say that at this moment, you may be experiencing the exact same push-pull in the opposite direction. The Washington Post has examined all the police shootings over the last, several years, and what their data is fascinating for what it doesn't show, which is that it basically shows that police shootings of these unarmed black people is ubiquitous across the country, right? But as Isabella Wilkerson pointed out a couple of years ago, the most high-profile cases, or majority of them, are in northern and western cities, i.e. George Floyd.
Right.
As other researchers have pointed out, we get a vicarious traumatization from the very idea that now these killings exist in perpetuity and is amplified on by media, social media, television, print media. So even though they don't exist in the same way as the white terror of lynching might have existed, in the same magnitude as white lynching would have existed when, during the beginning of Great Migration, the fact that so many more people see them produces the same effect. In addition to that, the police militarization of these northern and western cities is a function, is something that just does not exist in most southern cities. The SWAT team is created basically in part to battle the rise of the Black Panthers in California. New York and other cities develop stop and frisk to crack down on basically the effect of it is cracking down on young black men and boys. And that is exported to L.A., cities like L.A. and Chicago. There is no stop and frisk as a program in Birmingham,
mm-hmm.
or in Jackson, Mississippi. It's just not a thing. So that hypermilitarization, that vicarious traumatization of the shooting, the larger ones happening, or killings, the larger ones happening in these cities is part of that push. And then came on top of it a pandemic in which many of those northern and western cities, the black population were the ones who suffered greatly. For instance, at the second quarter of last year when everything closed down, essentially, I looked at black unemployment rates. Black unemployment in Chicago was three times the black unemployment rate in Chicago, in Atlanta, in the second quarter of last year. So there's that push. And then the pull is affordability,
mm-hmm.
of housing and property, the fact that the black middle class is thriving in many of these southern cities, according to Forbes. When Forbes does this list of where the black middle class is thriving, half of the cities on that list are southern cities. The fact that black-owned businesses are most highly concentrated in the Southeast. The fact that median family incomes are growing in the South. And even among people who without a college degree over the 30-year span, when you look at real wage growth, theirs has grown incredibly relative to other parts of the country. There's a possibility in the South of a comfort, safety that may not exist in those northern and western cities. And it's not everywhere in the South, but it is in the cities in the South. Mm. There are now 1,200 majority black cities in America. 90% of them are in the South.
So let's talk about that for a moment. Charles Blow is our guest. The name of the new book is The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. You talk in the book about the Great Migration and of people from the South seeking refuge and going to what you call destination cities. So in that reverse, there are destination cities in the South that people should eye.
Well, I just go through and try to round up actual cities that I think would be attracted to people returning on the Great Migration. Now, there's some people who their families are from the South, so they will have a homestead that may be attractive as well. But these are just places that you have no other aim, you want options that I'm setting up options. And so it's just a string of cities that roughly run along I-20 and then up the I-95 corridor. Many of them most of them are majority black. Most of them have black mayors. Many of them are state capitals. And one thing that I did when identifying those cities was also just to pay attention to the fact that there are three other great migrations that are happening at the same time reverse migration is happening. One is immigrant migration. One is urbanization migration, which is, to a large degree, millennials, young white people, college-educated, reversing the trends their parents made, which is move out in suburbs and then moving back into cities. But also, climate migration is a thing that's real. So just when I'm looking at those cities, when I was going through that list, I also make sure that there was none that are on the coast, you know, just do whatever mitigation I could do in this regard. Mm-hmm. Make sure that there's none on the coast, that I'm not moving anybody into a space where sea level rise would have the most impact. Making sure that there are none within historical floodplains of rivers. So just doing whatever mitigation you can. The heat, you can't. The heat is going to be the heat. The temperature is rising.
One of the points that you make in the book is that black people have been returning to the South for the past 40 years. You say that this really shows that this is fertile ground here because this has been happening over the past 4 or 5 decades.
Exactly. Well, you know, people were, and I was celebrating what happened in Georgia this election cycle.
Yes.
When black people experienced so much power in that election. Part of that was organizing by an amazing group of organizers, including Stacey Abrams. But the other side of that was that the black population of Georgia doubled from 1990 to 2020. And a large part of that is reverse migration. It goes from 1.7 million people to over 3.4 million people in 2020. The last time that Georgia went for a Democratic candidate, black people were not the majority of that coalition because black people were 25% of the state of Georgia. This time, they were 33% of the state of Georgia, and that made them, according to the ex-polls, the majority of the coalition that flipped the state for a candidate. That was the first time that it happened, at least since Reconstruction. I just don't know the date on Reconstruction. But it was also the first time that black people were a majority of the coalition that elected a senator of any party in the entire history of the Senate, and they didn't just elect one, they elected two.
I think it's also important to point out that you practice what you preach. You were a son of Louisiana, you move north, and then you have returned to the South and now live in Georgia and Atlanta. So you use your story as well as an example. So why is that important? And because it is young people, it is people who are going to come and say, yes, not only are we part of this movement, a political movement, but we can have what we want and we can also see through our career and have a better life if we do this.
Well, you know, 50-year-old men like myself, well-established where they are not going to be the bulk of any migration. That's just not how migrations work.
Right.
But I did have the privilege and ability to be able to do it, and I believe it's important to do, and so I did it. And I think that anyone who has the opportunity, the ability to move, should be to really consider it and do it regardless of age or position or stage in their life. But the bulk of it is what it, you know, often has been or probably always has been, is young people. People, the least encumbered, haven't started their lives yet, could start those lives anywhere and be anywhere and make that their home. Those are the people that I'm speaking to, and trying to lay out a case that you can have a great life in the South as well as other places. But in addition to that, you won't just have it because of economics, but you eventually you'll have it because you'll have the power to control the state in which you live, and that benefit will redound more to your children than to you. That there will be a space in this country that is not ruled in some way by white supremacy. There'll be a space in this country where state criminal code is written with an eye on racial equality and inclusion, and these laws that we know disproportionately affect the arrest and incarceration of black people can be expunged from those criminal codes. That's what the power really is, not just what you have now, which I think can be good, but what will your children have?
You tell such powerful stories in the book that part of the reason that people should look to moving south is for the police violence because of the systemic racial disparities and the social unrest, whether it be in Portland or New York or Minneapolis. Those stories are so powerful.
Yeah. I mean, the most prominent kind of Black Lives Matter cases, if you want to call them that, have been in the northern Western cities, although police shootings are kind of ubiquitous and widely spread all over the country.
Right. And in looking at the states that you mentioned, in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina in particular, what is the chance? What is the possibility of not only this great migration in reverse happening, but God forbid, like Georgia, those states turning blue?
Each state is kind of a different story. Mississippi is really important, I think, historically, just because Mississippi was a black power center in America in during Reconstruction. Gave us our first two black senators. By and large, the percentage of black men who were registered to vote were greater than those of white men. So it was where you wanted to be. And it was for that reason there was so much terror in Mississippi, and there was Mississippi became the first state to call a constitutional convention in 1890 to write white supremacy into its constitution to prevent black people from having the power that they had. So that's important to me. And also, Mississippi is now getting closer to 40% black. It doesn't take but a couple hundred thousand people to make Mississippi a majority black state.
So,
then there are small states like Delaware, which is the eighth blackest state in America.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take but a few, I don't know, I haven't done the math on that one, but it's so much smaller, it takes a smaller number of people to make it majority black. And it is a state already in the Northeast if for people who are not interested in moving all the way to what they consider the Deep South.
My final question for you, and it's one that comes because I'm fascinated by this story of the bills moving through the legislature in your now home state of Georgia, a Republican-controlled legislature, but the GOP looking to put restrictions on voting access in ways that African Americans and Democrats say would have a very large impact on Black voters. So what, while all of this is happening, we call for migration. What do we do about that?
Well, the first thing is to recognize that this is an American phenomenon. There are 43 states right now that are experiencing, that have restrictive laws proposed. They're not 43 southern states. Right? So these laws are happening everywhere, including here in Georgia. The second thing is to remember that this is how white supremacy has operated from the very beginning, which is that it has, every time that power was threatened, they sought ways to engineer an electorate that would take away the threat, to reduce the number of people who could vote, who did not vote in their interest. And so that is happening again. There is no way, this battle will never stay won even when you win it one time. You have to defend every inch, and it will always be a fight.
Charles Blow is a New York Times columnist and author of the new book, The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. Charles, I can't thank you enough for being with us. Be well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Again, Charles Blow is the author of The Devil You Know. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.